Stand by. Transmitting sound. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for joining us on the show this week. And first off, we speak with lifestyle expert Christine Eisner, who helps us learn how to merge our lives when you move in together as a couple. We're also joined by Mark Hamrick, who's the president of the National Press Club. He talks about how to protect reporters going into war zones following the brutal attack on CBS reporter Lara Logan in Egypt. We then lighten things up with Gina Lee in the Love Zone, and we also have a fabulous remix of Firework from Katy Perry. Lots to do. Let's go.
Capture your need for sound.
As much as we love the idea of coming together and living with our mate, it can be a challenging process to merge those two worlds together. And even after you're married, you never know what's going to happen. To help us understand how to make the transition much easier is lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, A Back to Basics Guide to a More Balanced Lifestyle, Christine Eisner. Christine, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Christine, I think a lot of couples, you know, get caught up in the romance of moving in together, but then forget that there's a harsh reality that they are indeed merging two tastes. What is the first step a couple should do to make, you know, things start off on the right foot?
I love the fact that you're doing this topic because so many people have this idea, as you say, that everything just sort of magically comes together and, you know, there's going to be a place of honor for his collection of racetrack shot glasses and also for her wonderful portrait of her great aunt, you know, Marie. And, you know, sometimes when it gets down to those concrete aspects of setting up home, it's not as easy as you think it might be. One of the things that I think is the most important, and it really is at the foundation of comfort living, is the idea of really focusing in on your own wants and needs. And when you are a couple, the important thing is to help the other person understand that. Because all of a sudden, if his shot glass collection, I'll go with that example, if you understand that his shot glass collection are memories, that each glass is a memory of a different experience, then, you know, it becomes more than just a collection of shot glasses. And, you know, the same thing, if he understands what her relationship is with this aunt, then it just helps. So I think that's really the first step in the process.
And, you know, I think, Christine, a lot of women get caught up in the notion that they are the keepers of the household and that what they want, you know, sort of design-wise, lifestyle-wise, is what should end up happening in the home. What do you tell women so they sort of take their mate's taste into account?
Well, you know, I say a lot of times people think that the house is the woman's or, you know, whoever is that person at home. And then, you know, men end up creating, you know, the ever increasingly popular man caves, whether it's in the garage, whether it's in the basement or, you know, or maybe they get a study. But I think really, you know, women need to create space for themselves too. Instead of sort of generally having the whole house, I think women need a she cave. And I think if she has her place and he has his place, then the rest of the space becomes more open to both of their inputs. So, you know, that's a key part, and I think it's this everything but the garage is for her actually ends up doing people a disservice.
And with regards to that, Christine, how would that work? Because, for example, let's just say there was no garage for his stuff and there's like only one sort of extra room. Like, how do you decide who gets that, or can there be like it kind of split down the middle?
Well, I think, you know, it could be a shelf. It could be a wall. It could be, you know, it doesn't have to be a room. I mean, especially because not everybody lives in, you know, in big houses. So it can be, you know, the equivalent of an altar, you know, of a little special place where his collection is, where his sort of, you know, treasures, I call them treasures. In comfort living, I basically am giving the readers, giving people a new language for talking about quality of life. So it really isn't about, you know, square footage. It's about meaning. And actually, there's a wonderful exercise that's in my book, and you have a copy too, so feel free to put it on your website or whatever. But it's on page 16 of my book, and basically it's a grid of words, and I use this with couples and families and individuals, and it is amazing what it does. But I ask people to just circle the words that describe how you want to feel in your space. So it might be friendly, traditional, stimulating, casual, vibrant, glitzy, romantic, whatever. And, you know, he'll circle his words, she'll circle her words, and of course they're not going to be the same, but it's really amazing because when I work with couples, you know, I help them focus on the words that they have in common. And so all of a sudden, that drawing a line in the room isn't as important, because if you start to have an understanding for where the other person's coming from, what they want, like if a guy wants a room, you know, wants to feel like he's in a masculine space, well, you know, if she really understands that that's an important thing to him, then you end up coming up with these opportunities to gift the other person. And it's like, you know what, I'm going to choose this kind of a frame around these photographs, or this kind of a rug, or this kind of fabric for the throw pillows. And all of a sudden, just because of being more aware of each other and where you're coming from, you end up not on opposite sides of the net. You end up on the same side of the net, and it makes a huge difference. I see it time and time again with people I work with.
I have to ask you about something you brought up just a few moments ago with regards to the space. And you said, you know, certain couples don't have a lot of space, and that, you know, if they do just have a shelf, it's enough for them. Is it because of the fact that it is their shelf, they get to put whatever they want on it, so that's what will give them sort of peace of mind? Because I think everybody growing up, especially if they've grown up in a family where, you know, they've had to share a room with someone else or whatever it is, or, you know, even being in university and being in cramped quarters, when you do get that house or you do get that larger apartment, I think we all just wish that we could have that man cave or she cave to put all our stuff. But you're saying that just a small space, it can work.
I think it absolutely can work, because I really don't think it's about stuff. I don't think quality of life is about stuff. I don't think it's about how expensive something is. I think it's just about these messages that objects and elements and memories can give us. And, you know, sometimes people that are in big sprawling houses, I think it's actually easier to get lost. It's easier to become less intentional about how you set up your surroundings, and more importantly, the routines that you do in where you live or where you work. So in a way, the person who has the small apartment and can just carve out a little corner of a room, or, you know, the night table, or, you know, a mantle or a shelf, or a, you know, objects on a tray, you know, on a side table, that can end up being actually even more powerful than trying to do it in a whole house, because it can get a little bit, you know, diffused.
Joining us on the show is lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living, Christine Eisner. Make sure to check her out, www.comfortlivingbychristine.com. How do you amicably decide who gets to keep what? Because I think, you know, a lot of guys would want to, you know, ditch her rose petal painting, and you know, the women might want to get rid of those peewee trophies, you know, throw them in the trash. Where is the happy medium, Christine?
Well, I think you have to be respectful and considerate of where each person is coming from. And again, if you approach it, the exercise that I talked about is incredibly helpful. And in communicating on what are the things that mean the most to you, if, you know, we can't have, you know, you can't combine two lives into one life or one and a half lives and not have some things go by the wayside. So I think it's really important to communicate the things that are most important, and then maybe they can come together. You know, if that painting is not the most important thing to her, well, then that's something that can go by the wayside. If it is important to her and he absolutely hates it, well, then maybe there's a place, you know, on her side of the bed, in her side of the bedroom, or maybe there's a wall in the bathroom where, you know, her sink is, so that she can see it every time she brushes her teeth. And it's not necessarily relegating it to the bathroom, but it actually is putting it in a place where, again, I talk about the routines, where it becomes part of the routine that is her life, not necessarily that is his life. So I think that you need to see, you know, you need to talk about where do your eyes go, and try to put those things in places where they're going to be touching the person who they mean most. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And a question I would have for you too is, I almost feel like, you know, if you are merging two worlds, it's almost an exercise as well of self-awareness, because I feel like if you, you know, like you said, you have to be understanding of your partner, and there is that happy medium where, you know, some things will probably have to go by the wayside. Do you think as a person, you need to become less defensive? Because I think a lot of people, you know, for example, you know, for me, I have all these karate trophies that I've acquired since I was 6 years old. And I'm sure some of them, or some people would think, you know, what the hell is she still doing with these things? But, you know, for me, they represent a specific day, a specific combat that I did. So they mean something to me. And I can't imagine parting with any of them. So, how would I sort of work with that if someone else was like, what the hell is that?
Well, you know, I think we all, there's a word that I use called streamlining. People talk a lot about decluttering, but what streamlining is about, it's about getting rid of the obstacles in your life, the things that get in your way, but it's also about recognizing the things that are important to you. And I think that we each need to own up for our own treasures and our own obstacles before we get into the conversation with the other person. You know, so you have come to that conclusion that those are really important to you. You don't want to have him tell you something that is or isn't important to you when you haven't even figured that out for yourself. So I think that's a really important part of the process. Don't let your mate do the dirty work for you. You know, we have to step up to each of that process on our own. But then, in the case of those trophies, I've done this with my son, who has a lot of, and he was a karate person too. But, you know, there is I created in his room, because they're not part of his active life, but, you know, they are treasures, and they're bridges to a place that he was at in the past that was important to him. So I actually put up a shelf all around his room, but about 12 inches from the ceiling.
Oh, wow.
So it basically is a high shelf that's out of the way, but that is visible. And so you could put that into a place where it meant something to you. It could be in, you know, it could be just on one wall. But so it could be up there out of the way, or it could be just a shelf that you say, this is an important place, you know. And depending on how much of your presence you want it to be in, you either put it at, you know, right at eye level, or maybe you put that kind of a shelf around the perimeter of your closet. You know, the closets don't necessarily go all the way up to the ceiling, so maybe there's a way to store them, but in a way that respects them too. So those are some ideas as to how you might do that. But I do think it's really important, and that's where this recognizing what your treasures are and writing them down, both of you, writing them down, and you'd be surprised how someone says, "Wow, I didn't realize that was that important to you." And then all of a sudden you hear them saying, "Well, if that's the case, then maybe we can do this." And this is him speaking for your karate trophies. And it really is. And then in turn, you're saying, "Oh, you know, I didn't realize that those, those matches, my husband came into our marriage with a whole big thing of matches from different restaurants. Well, we started to use them instead of them just being in a place. I've actually put them in different places around the house, and gradually we use them. 25 years later, we're now on to new matches."
Wow, that's amazing, and a great tip. And another area where I think, you know, things can get contentious is deciding on, you know, furniture versus electronics. You know, the man probably wants the flat screen, and she might want to go with, you know, a coffee table or an armoire. How do you work that out, Christine?
Well, you know, I think that's, you know, a matter, I mean, you know, most likely you don't have the money to do both at once. And so I think it's just sort of a taking turns of working. Again, if there's a respect for the process, if it's not the only thing you'll ever be spending money on, then, you know, then maybe it's, well, you know, maybe we really need this to, you know, maybe the coffee table is really important because it creates a, what I call a campfire, a center of energy that draws you in. And if there's nothing there, then, you know, then you have something that's taking away from the comfort in a room. So if he understands why you want the coffee table, then maybe it becomes easier for him to say, you know what, you're right. I really don't have anywhere to put my feet or my drink or whatever. And you know, if you like that coffee table, great. But then she might say, well, you know, let's, what kind of coffee table would you like? And, you know, so that might be how that, that discussion happens. If it ends up being the flat screen TV, then, you know, maybe if she has a little bit of a say in it, or maybe it's just that point where she says, you know what, sure, just, you know, just go with it. But again, I think when you tap into the other person, instead of like digging your heels in the ground and saying, we're getting a flat screen TV and that's it. Well, you know, I mean, we're humans. I mean, I don't know about you, but I would dig my feet in on the other side.
And
I say, well, then I'm going to go spend the money on the coffee table. And then, you know, you're broke. You can't pay the rent.
And you know, it's funny you brought that up, you know, because if there is, you know, a real power struggle that's going on, Christine, is that when, you know, the couple should call in someone like yourself so that, you know, World War, you know, 14 doesn't break out? Because, I mean, you would hope that each couple could sort of work it out on their own, but you know, if it's two strong personalities, one might not, you know, either of them might not be willing to back down.
It's a really good idea to call someone in because, you know, not, and you know, it's amazing how quickly, I mean, I'm talking about 20 minutes, a situation can diffuse. I mean, I worked with a couple and it was obvious that they were, you know, she was moving into his decorated bachelor pad and she was about 20 years younger and there was really no room for her. And I could sense that they were, some people sort of say, you know, you're sort of a house whisperer. I was like, well, more a lifestyle whisperer. But it was very easy to see that they were in pain about it. And, you know, I had them do the exercise. We talked through it together. I had them, you know, put down their, what, list their treasures. And all of a sudden, the whole tone of things changed. And the cool thing was that, you know, years and years later, you know, it was not a quickie kind of fix. It was something that they carried with them because they had a greater awareness of who they were and how they fit together and what they could do for each other, you know, most importantly.
And I wanted to ask you about, you know, something that I was reading over with regards to your information on your website. What's an energy center, Christine? And is that something where, you know, the couple is making memories together? Is that how that works?
Well, a campfire, if you think about a real campfire, you know, there's light, there's warmth, and I don't know about you, but and you know, it's impossible not to be drawn into the feeling of that gives. And I this is basically and it is a center of energy, and it's a center of energy that creates a sense of connection and warmth, as opposed to like a focal point, which is something that you look at arm's distance, at the, you know, across a room. A campfire is like a shawl. It just wraps around you. And that is what I mean. That is a center of energy. And so if you come home to, you know, to a house and you walk, or, you know, you walk in and there's already a lamp lit and inviting you in, and the tables, you know, there's a two-place setting set. I'm speaking couples. There's two-place setting set. And, you know, a candle and some matches on the table, and you've got the CD and the, you know, or not, forget even the music. You have a clue of what's for dinner. Maybe you went out in the morning and you saw that you had eggs, and so you think, okay, well, we're going to have, you know, we'll have breakfast for dinner tonight. That is the kind of, and the light turning on is because you've put a light timer on it to turn on before you come home at night. That is what you've done, is you've created a center of energy, a campfire that draws you in for some meaningful, for a feeling of comfort and joy and meaning at the end of the day. That, if you contrast that, you know, this warm glow of, you know, and the feeling that you're being received by your home, contrast that to coming in, the house is dark. You open the fridge, you know, nothing speaks at you. You end up pulling out something, you know, milk and having a bowl of cereal while you're standing by the sink. That's the difference between a center of energy that really welcomes you in, and coming into to just the skeleton of a structure instead of a real home.
Christine, you've been fantastic. Thank you so much. And I have to ask you, where can people get a copy of your book?
They can get a copy of it on my website, which, as you said, is comfortlivingbychristine.com. And it's also sold through Amazon and Barnes & Noble. I won't say Borders right now because they're not. But Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and on my website. And actually, for your listeners, if they are on my website and they put in friend in the promo code, then I will. They can get it for 10% off. Sorry, 20% off.
Oh, that's amazing, Christine. Thank you so much. I really appreciate that, and I really appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's Christine Eisner again, a lifestyle expert and author of Comfort Living. Check her out, www.comfortlivingbychristine.com.
Stand by.
The Love Zone
with Gina Lee
on The Kelly Alexander Show.
Welcome to The Love Zone. I'm Gina Lee. Sometimes it doesn't take much to get in the mood for love, but it doesn't hurt to take advantage of some natural aids that can help fan the flames higher. They say the way to a person's heart is through the stomach, so I'm going to explore some edible aphrodisiacs that you can use to whet the appetite for love. Shall I start with the most popular? I bet you can already guess what it is. Oysters. Yes, raw oysters have long been credited for increasing the libido, especially in men. They're very high in zinc, which raises sperm and testosterone production. So chuck a few of those bad boys down and it'll be on till dawn. Here's another classic aphrodisiac for you. Chocolate. Come Valentine's Day, all the stores will be stocked to the ceilings with boxes of these bonbons. Aside from it tasting good, there are a couple of chemicals that make chocolate sexy. It contains theobromine, a stimulating alkaloid similar to caffeine. Gets you going. Chocolate also helps the brain produce serotonin, the feel-good chemical that makes your toes curl in contentment. This may be why some people actually prefer having chocolate over sex. Remember, when it comes to chocolate, the darker, the better. Now, if sweets aren't your thing, there are a host of other edible aphrodisiacs to choose from, like asparagus. 17th century English herbalist Nicholas Culpepper wrote that asparagus stirs up lust in man and woman. Along with other great nutrients, asparagus contains folic acid, said to boost the histamine production necessary for reaching orgasm. So, see that you get those sexy spears on your plate. If veggies don't appeal to you, try some nuts. Almonds in particular. With their high levels of vitamin E and magnesium, almonds can improve your mood and general well-being, which is always a turn-on. Now let's not forget about fruits. Bananas are seen as an aphrodisiac and a symbol of fertility. Full of magnesium, potassium, and B vitamins, this phallic fruit contains the bromelain enzyme, said to enhance the male libido. What do you call sliced bananas dipped in dark chocolate and sprinkled with slivered almonds? Three ways to heaven. Another fruit that's not as sweet but still sexy is the avocado. Associated with male sexuality, ancient Aztecs called the avocado tree ahuacuatl, or testicle tree, because of how pairs of the hanging fruit resembled, well, you know what. With a high content of folic acid, as well as vitamin B and potassium, avocados are also said to boost immune function. The creamy fruit also has a smooth texture that can be quite sensuous, so get cozy with your guacamole. There are many more aphrodisiacs out there, but I'll leave you with one final one. Raw egg yolks. High in vitamin B6 and B5, eggs help to balance hormone levels and fight stress. Raw egg yolks eaten before sex are considered to enhance one's libido. So if you've got a good control over your gag reflex, knock some back like Rocky Balboa and get in the bedroom. Bon appetit!
Looking for a simple, you see. Love is a boy, sexuality. I'm with you.
It's been all over the news recently that CBS News correspondent Lara Logan was brutally attacked in Cairo's Tahrir Square after the resignation of Egyptian President Mubarak. This horrible incident serves as a reminder of the dangers journalists face around the world as they try to get that important information out to the public. Joining us to discuss these dangers and what can be done about it is Mark Hamrick, president of the National Press Club located in Washington, D.C. Mark, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you, Kelly.
Mark, first of all, how did this attack on Ms. Logan happen? Did she sort of get separated from her crew in that mob of people?
No, I don't think that was really the issue. I think the issue was that events there, and we don't know a lot about it yet, but I think the events there were such that, you know, it was obviously a quickly unfolding revolution when you get right down to it, and in those sorts of circumstances, and this one being sort of highly extraordinary, the rule of law breaks down, things become unsettled, it's a crisis atmosphere, and she and her fellow crew members were outnumbered, and I think it's essentially as simple as that.
And how did she get sort of saved from this attack? How did she break free?
Well, I don't think we know a lot of details about either how the events unfolded or how she was rescued. I think the focus of the story has been simply that the attack happened, that she was able to get back to the United States, that she was hospitalized fairly briefly and has since gone home in the Washington area to recover. My sense is that we might know more about the sort of tick-tock of how she did sort of find safety and how all that unfolded. But, you know, you may have seen the initial story or statement that came from CBS News where they simply said that she was brutally beaten and sexually assaulted and that there'd be no further comment by CBS at that time. I guess we'll just have to see how much more either she or that organization want to disclose.
And was she specifically targeted for who she is, Mark, or were any journalists sort of, you know, in a dangerous situation?
No, there have been plenty of people who have faced perilous circumstances in Egypt as the story has unfolded, and I don't think we know exactly because we haven't yet seen any sign that the persons who are responsible have been arrested. That's one of the things that I said as the head of the press club about a week ago when we issued the statement that we do hope that the Egyptian authorities can make sure that those persons who are responsible are brought to justice, and I was heartened to see that by the end of last week, both Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the White House essentially echoed that. And, we'll just have to see whether indeed that does happen. You can imagine right now that there are a lot of priorities on the part of the authorities in Egypt to not only sort of get things back to normal there, but to also you know, I guess they were sort of in the process of forming a new government and trying to see how what level of transparency and democratic rule are going to be allowed to transpire. And, you know, you can imagine a scenario where, given the amount of attention that this has been given, that, you know, they might want to try to indicate that they're on the case, but we won't know any more until we hear something more about it.
And Mark, if we talk about sort of the issue at large, I think a lot of us, the public, think that journalists are relatively safe, you know, when they're out sort of reporting overseas. But obviously, this is not the case, and the prime example being right now Ms. Logan's situation. Apart from the fact that they could be killed, what are some of the other dangers that I think we as the public don't know about?
Well, I think, first of all, we do need to focus on the fact that they're killed, because I was talking to someone last week. We have a committee at the National Press Club in Washington called the Freedom of the Press Committee, and it's one of the 27 committees we have there. It's a robust organization, and we have very smart people who are members of that committee who are working more on a day-to-day basis with these kinds of issues. One of the persons who was attending works for a wonderful institution here in Washington called the News. It's a massive structure where everything from a large portion of the Berlin Wall is displayed to the tower, or the top tower from one of the two World Trade Center buildings is there. If you're in Washington, I'd suggest you visit sometime, in other words, your listeners. But my point about that is there was a volunteer at our meeting, and she said, you know, we go by the exhibit that shows the number of journalists who are hurt on a regular basis, and people are just astonished that members of the general public don't know that. So what I'd like to mention is that, for example, last year, 57 journalists were killed just in the course of doing their job. So far this year, that number is 5. But this year so far, and this is numbers that we get from an organization called Reporters Without Borders, and I'd recommend that if people want to know more, they go to the Reporters Without Borders website. 151 journalists have been imprisoned so far this year, and I was just in touch with their Washington leader this morning to get sort of a status update from her to see where things are seemingly most perilous at the moment. And she said, really, right now it's Iran, because there have been 7 people arrested there, 7 journalists arrested there in the last month, and 8 have been sentenced to jail. Obviously, there has not been, as best we can tell, much change in the situation in Iran as it relates to the ruling party's situation, to use a broad brushstroke. The people there have demonstrated, but it doesn't appear that there's been the same sort of change there that has occurred in Egypt. So, yeah, I mean, that is the one, I think, a very significant takeaway from the attention that's been shining on Lara Logan's unfortunate and despicable situation, in the sense that she was attacked, is that this happens all the time, unfortunately, attacks of one form or the other, or people who are shot to death or killed doing their job as journalists. And it happens all over the world. You look, for example, last year, some of the hot spots, 11 in Pakistan, 11 journalists killed there, 7 in Mexico, 4 in the Philippines, 7 in Iraq. So Egypt is the place that we've been paying a lot of attention to recently, but last year, seemingly, you know, not that unusual of a year in any particular way, but 57 journalists killed, and as I just mentioned, those deaths were distributed, you know, across a variety of countries around the world.
And so, Mark, so to clarify, the numbers that you just put out, it's not just American journalists, it's journalists from all over the world.
Yeah, they tended to be people who were from their home country. You know, you can imagine, for example, in Mexico, how that works, in the sense that, you know, it's a very dangerous situation down there right now. We tend to be, in the United States, sometimes a little U.S.-centric, but no, we're talking about people who, people from all over the world who've run into these horrendous conditions.
Joining us on the show is Mark Hamrick, president of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Check them out, press.org. Mark, you know, a question I had just as you were sort of speaking is the fact that why do you think the public is not sort of made more aware that their journalists aren't, you know, surviving or being hurt or being, you know, taken to jail? Because, you know, we watch the news every night, whether it's CBS, NBC, any of these ones, CNN, and a lot of these reporters are, you know them, but they're sort of, you know, nameless. And how come their plight is not getting across to their public?
Well, to the earlier question, in the cases where a lot of these things happen, they do tend to be journalists from other countries. And so I think in the United States, the focus of most, I'll just say broadcast journalism, since that's the sector in which I work, we tend to be somewhat domestically focused in the U.S. with the way that reportage occurs. I think maybe you're a little better on that count than we are in Canada, where you know you tend to have more of a more diverse populace, and therefore there's a more organic interest about how things occur around the world. I'd also say that there tends to be there's a couple other things that play into that. One is, you know, people tend to not think about, let's say, the supply chain in our food system until it's disrupted, right? So let's say you're living where there's a natural disaster. You tend to think, oh, I should be able to get my tomatoes from South America on a regular basis, and then a disaster of some kind occurs, and then people start to think about that. I think that journalism and the news business is somewhat the same in the sense that people take it for granted, and maybe as journalists we should be somewhat thankful that they do that, but there's also you know, a massive amount of resource commitment and hard work that goes into the news business, and particularly when people are reporting from some of these crisis stories, it's not easy. In fact, it's extremely difficult and dangerous, and an earlier example of that was when people were reporting in Haiti almost a little over a year ago when the earthquake occurred down there. And I just know, you know, some of the conditions my colleagues faced down there, it was just very, it was scary, you know, and people were didn't know what they were getting into. And you know, you've had comparable situations here. The other thing is that I think one more thing I'll mention, and that is I don't think journalists and people who run the news business always want to talk about it very much, because it's sort of the process of how we go about reporting the news. We tend to think that people aren't as interested in it as maybe they are or as we would like for them to be. And that's something that I've been sort of talking up here recently, is that I think as journalists we do have a responsibility to engage the public in a discussion about the news business, because you know, you see that in the social networking space, people actually do have a high degree of interest in how the news business goes about getting the job done, and I think that we have a responsibility to engage them in that kind of a conversation.
And Mark, a question I had as well is, you know, myself being a female broadcaster, I don't even like to use those two words. I just want to be known as, you know, Kelly the broadcaster. But because I am a female, you know, things are a little bit different. And I know that for female correspondents, even though they probably don't want it to be different, it has to be different, especially if they are going overseas. Is it particularly dangerous for them? Is it a whole new level or playing field for them when they leave home?
Well, I mean, I guess the nature of the way that they can be put into danger is a little different than if they are a man, if one is a man. But I think it's equally dangerous on all sides. It's just, you know, the way that an attack can occur, the sort of DNA of that changes a little bit. But I suppose the reaction to the Lara Logan story has somewhat reflected the fact that she is a woman, and that people say sort of, you know, good gracious, that's the most horrible thing that could ever happen to a woman, and isn't that something that we all react to in a strong way, and that's appropriate. And I think that a woman who is in a situation like that is fully aware that that's the risk that she faces, and to some degree that perhaps makes them all the more brave, in the sense that she was a person who wanted to go to Afghanistan immediately after the 9/11 attacks, rushing toward danger, as it were, as opposed to fleeing from it. And that's what makes people like Lara Logan and you know, many, many other people around the world special kinds of journalists, because those are the sort of stories that they want to be involved with. And also we should say that when stories like that demand coverage, we need people like that who are willing to, in a sense, not think primarily about their own personal safety, but thinking about the fact that there is a mission that's associated with journalism, and we need people to fulfill that mission. There obviously has been a lot of discussion and a lot written about the fact that she is a woman, and the question about whether that changes the landscape for how assignments are doled out in the future. But I tend to think that most people have a pretty short memory, and there'll be another story that takes precedence over this in the near term if that hasn't already occurred, and that resources being what they are in the news business at a time of, let's say, great dislocation in journalism in terms of the economic models being challenged and changing, people will want to get the best person to a story that they can. And I think that people like Lara Logan will be wanting to be assigned to those stories as well, as they always have been.
And a two-part question for you, Mark. What is the National Press Club, you know, for those of us who don't really know what it's about? And how can you help as an organization, correspondents like Lara Logan, and the situation that she sort of went through?
Well, first of all, the club is a 104-year-old organization based in Washington with about 3,500 members. The majority of our members are journalists, and we have a professional staff that's very capable, and then we have a board of governors that's comprised mostly of journalists. I'm a full-time journalist working for the Associated Press and have been on the board there for nearly a decade. We have a real broad mission in the sense of we call ourselves, the world's leading professional organization for journalists, and it's engaged in all kinds of different things, whether it's helping to provide professional training for our members and others in the public who have an interest in what we do, as well as for professional communicators. We have a number of awards that we give out in journalism, both for reporting overseas as well as within the United States. It initially began more as a social kind of organization, as you can imagine, in the early part of the 20th century, where some journalists were just looking for a place to engage in some fellowship. But it quickly changed to something that was more focused. President Franklin D. Roosevelt held the first of our luncheon series speeches that have become somewhat very well associated. In fact, frankly, I organized a luncheon for Prime Minister Chrétien there in the late 90s when he was in power, and we had a president who was from Canada at that time. So to your question about what we can do, here's what we have done, and that is we've issued two statements, the last of which has gotten a fair amount of play, where we urge the Egyptian authorities to bring those attackers to justice. And I think, to the degree that that has helped to engage a debate about how you do proceed after something like this, that's been a positive thing. We've also begun to a process where we hope to reach out to the Egyptian ambassador here in Washington to express our dismay, and we also engage in a process where we provide something akin to counseling to journalists after they come back to Washington through an organization that is very intelligent about how to proceed on something like that. And so we do all kinds of things, and then we had a panel discussion, I think, on Friday night about it, where we had people talking about just the challenges in the midst of that story. So we do it, across any number of different ways. And as you mentioned, for people who are more interested to find out about the club, the website is www.press.org. And, there's a forum on there in which people can submit questions or send comments to us. And we also have, as I mentioned, the luncheon program. The first luncheon that I hosted in my term was with the head of our central bank, Ben Bernanke, and that garnered a lot of attention. And we'll be continuing to do things like that as the year proceeds.
And Mark, just a final question for you. Do you think that with the sort of increasing, unrest in the world, it seems right now, because I know Libya has just flared up again, do you think it's going to be more difficult for reporters to get into these areas? Are they going to be more of a target?
Anytime you have an unsettled situation, it gets more difficult because you don't have the same infrastructure to support not only travel to the country, but also entry. And then there's just the issue of personal safety. So, I think anytime you have the level of unrest that we've seen recently, it will become increasingly perilous. And, this could be the deadliest year yet for journalists to the extent that we've kept track in recent years. And, unfortunately, that goes hand in hand with the mission that we have, and that is to get the story out, no matter the difficulty of the circumstances.
Mark, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it today.
Thank you, Kelly. Good speaking with you.
That's Mark Hamrick, president of the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. Check them out, www.press.org.
Capture your need for sound.
All right, so here's the deal. As you know, I always try to keep on top of what's going on in the world as much as I can to sort of bring that to you to make sure we're sort of all on the same page and aware of what's going on around us. And one of the things I try to do is, you know, obviously try to stay in touch with what's happening in the entertainment world. And you can laugh at me if you want, but I thought it would be a really good idea if I actually headed out to see the Justin Bieber Never Say Never movie. Now, I know, you know, much of his fan following are the teens and tweens, but you can't deny that he has become a global phenomenon. And, you know, whether you're 12 or 20, he seems to be the man of the hour right now. And it's important to sort of know what our kids are paying attention to. So, you know, obviously, as a radio announcer, I get to play Justin Bieber fairly often, you know, on the radio machine. And, you know, I do know a little bit, you know, about what's going on with him. But I never really entirely knew his backstory. And when I found out that his movie was sort of a bit of a, not really a tell-all, but, you know, an introduction as to how he got where he is today, I thought it would be a cool idea if I went out to see the movie. So laugh if you must, but I'm all about, you know, checking out the important entertainment news for you. So I headed out to see the movie, and I have to say, I was pleasantly surprised. Now, obviously, there are some parts in the movie that is specifically tailored to his teens and tween fans, but it was actually very interesting to see how he got his start. And, you know, I have to say, I'm proud of him as a fellow Canadian to know that he came from this town that's not really big at all, sort of north, I guess it's northwest or maybe southwest of Toronto. It's kind of hard to tell, but it's definitely west of Toronto. I guess it's about maybe an hour and a half outside of Toronto, Stratford, Ontario. And to just sort of see that he could come from these humble roots. And, you know, now he's on the global stage and traveling all over the world performing for his fans. And, you know, as much as people want to make Justin Bieber, you know, out to be this kid act that was completely manufactured, I have to say that that's not the case. I mean, obviously, he does have a team around him that has helped to propel him to this world stage. But if you start at the beginning where you see these home videos of when he was a young child, he totally had musical aspirations and an inclination to play instruments. And he does play the drums. He does play the guitar. He does play the piano. And I think he had a few lessons, but it sounds like it was mostly self-taught, especially with regards to the drumming. So that was just very inspirational. And then there's a video footage of him, again, home video footage of basically when he you know, tried out to be the Stratford Star, which is obviously a very small version of almost like Star Search for that particular town in Ontario, Stratford. And you see him, I guess he was like maybe 11 or 12 at the time, you know, battling it out against these other kids. And he came in second place. But you just see the drive that he had in him at that age to want to do well and to want to perform for basically, you know, anyone, anywhere. And he sang all these different musical styles. Again, you see this on the home video footage. He was singing some Motown stuff, some R&B stuff, and he could really carry it off. And he also asked his parents, and I guess his grandparents who seemed to help sort of raise him, to let him sing, basically to be a busker, to sing outside of the Avon Theater in Stratford. And he was doing this again at a young age, playing guitar. Again, he might have been 10, 11 at the time. And he was doing it, you know, out there on his own. You know, a lot of kids at that age are very shy, but he was out there doing his thing and busking and having a great time, it seems. So you really have to give Justin Bieber credit, along with his parents and his grandparents, for helping to foster his dreams. And then again, then you start to see how things happened when he was found by his manager, Scooter Braun. And then, you know, how it sort of took off from there with Usher getting involved. And then again, trying to get a larger fan base. And, you know, as radio announcers, we're always told, you know, how important social media is. Everybody's on Facebook, on Twitter. And it seems that, you know, Justin and his management team really knew that that was going to be the way that they needed to go in order to get a fan following. And, You know, his manager even said, you know, they would make him play everywhere and anywhere. They put him on in a van, on a bus, in planes, and sent him all over the United States to all these little towns and then bigger cities as things started to go well, and started just this grassroots following. And that's how he built his fan base. At first, it was 20 kids, and then, you know, 40 or 50 and 60 and 70 and a couple hundred. And then that's how it went. So you can't deny sort of tipping your hat at Justin and his young management team, because they're all fairly young. You know, it seems like early 30s, and they all seem to have this understanding that they needed to get the kids and, you know, win them over one by one. So, you know, I just wanted to sort of put that out there. Again, you know, Justin Bieber is not someone that I would necessarily listen to musically, but he definitely has the drive. He definitely has the talent. He's not just a manufactured kid act. I think he is surrounded by a very good management team. He has a vocal coach. They call her Mama Jan. She actually worked with Usher in the past, and she seems to really keep him, you know, grounded and focused on what he's trying to achieve, because he is a 16-year-old kid, soon to be 17, and, you know, he still has childlike tendencies, which he should, but she's great to sort of keep him focused and know what he needs to do. So I can't actually be more surprised, and again, just want to tip my hat at Justin for his professionalism at such a young age, as well as his desire to achieve his goals, and the management team that are surrounding him, because as much as they're all making money and, you know, sort of striving for, you know, more success, I think they really do care about Justin and his well-being. So I think he actually has surrounded himself with a good team. So best of luck to them. And you know what? I think you will be pleasantly surprised if you, whether you go out to the movie theater and see the movie, or if you wait to see it on DVD. I really think you should watch it. And then you may look at Justin through different colored glasses.
Bring on the remix. Do you ever feel like a plastic bag drifting through the wind, wanting to start again? Do you ever feel this old paper thin, like a house of cards, one blow from caving in? Do you ever feel already buried deep, 6 feet under screens, but no one seems to hear a thing? Do you know that there's still a chance for you? There's a spark in you. You just gotta ignite.
Across the sky, baby, you're a
That's Katy Perry and Firework, remixed by Bieko Rindt on The Kelly Alexander Show. We also heard from Brandy and her song Aphrodisiac from 2004. Well, thanks so much for joining me on the show this week. A big thank you to my guests, Christine Eisner and Mark Hamrick. Also to the always amazing Gina Lee. And make sure to tune in next week because one of my guests is going to be Dr. Michael DeFranco. He's an expert in sports medicine, and he's going to tell us how to prevent our kids from getting sports injuries. A very important topic because so many of our kids are involved in sports activities. So have a great week. Any comments or questions? Kelly at KellyAlexanderShow.com. You and I will chat soon.
The Kelly Alexander Show is hosted by Kelly Alexander. Produced by Esteban Vargas, Barbara Purcell, Chris Paré, and Kelly Alexander. Original themes and production music composed by Ian Campbell. Thanks for listening.